First of all, I'd like to pay respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land, which is the land of the Kamara Girl people, who are the clan of the Eora Nation. And let me introduce Bante first. Most of you know Bante Sidato is an Australian monk and scholar, a former musician as well, with post-punk band Moffat's Vineyard. Many years ago, he's been.
I'll never let it die.
He's been a Buddhist monk for over 30 years, 32 years, I believe. He ordained in Thailand and founded the Santi Forest Monastery in 2003. And also, Bante co-founded the Sutta Central Net to make early Buddhist texts freely accessible. And on that note, there's also the Sutta Print Project. If you're interested, I've got to bring the pamphlet. But if you'd like to make a contribution, feel free to do so. The books that you also.
Oh, Tom's here. Yeah. Oh, maybe we'll get Tom to say a few words on it. Yeah. After later on.
Sure.
Yeah. Is that okay?
Thank you. Yeah. Yes, that's Bante. And also, we are fortunate to have Nadine. So a little bit about Dr. Nadine Levy. Holds a PhD in sociology and honors in law and gender studies. This bio is inaccurate, please correct me. Her research explores women's lived experience. She has taught law, gender studies, sociology, and criminology for over a decade with a student-centered, reflective approach grounded in critical theory. Previously a lawyer and advocate in the community sector, she's also a Buddhist insight meditation teacher with a special interest in the intersection of Buddhism and sociology. So without further ado, I'd like to hand it over to Bante and Nadine.
I didn't know you were a lawyer.
That's embarrassing. I can't believe that was revealed tonight.
So your legal past stalks you like my rock and roll past.
That's a very old bio.
That's a very
I
old
can't
bio.
Remember being a lawyer, but they tell me I did it.
Okay. Yeah. So, hi everyone, and so today we'll do some chanting. Nadine will lead us with some guided meditations. I have a bit of a break, and then the Dhamma talk on the topic of misogyny. And I especially invited Nadine along today because we have been working together on an article on this topic for the Bloomsbury Book of Contemporary Buddhist Ethics, which has been put together by some academic friends of ours. And we just submitted the absolutely final version. Oh, was it a couple of few days ago?
Yeah.
So this is like final version anyway.
This is a celebration, really, isn't it?
So yeah, we celebrated that. Let's begin with some chanting. Do we have our chanting sheets? Anyone who needs a chanting sheet? If you don't know how to recite Pali, there is an ancient tradition of mumbling along and pretending you know the words. That's how we all learn, so don't be shy. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. We don't want to get kicked out because of being too loud. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Duryam Buddham saranam gacchami, Duryam Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dhyambi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Dhyambi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dhyambi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Dhyambi Sangham Saranam Gacchami.
Iti piso
Bhagava Arahaṁ Sammasambuddho Vijja Charana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhamma Sarati Sadhadeva Manusanam Bhagavati Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sandirthiko Akaliko Edipasiko Upanayiko Pachatam Veditago Vinyuhiti Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yadidam Chattari Purisa Yugani Artha Purisa Pungala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakirneyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttaram Punyaketam Lokasati.
So Nadine, can I invite you to lead some meditation?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. It's a real honour. So the invitation tonight is to settle into your posture. So you might do that by feeling into the body, noticing what's happening in the inside. You might have brought the day with you, it's very likely. You might notice that the body's tense. You might notice that you're holding in certain areas, or you might notice that the body's relaxed. Whatever's present is absolutely welcome. And so the invitation is to sense into the body. Just notice how you're sitting this evening. If you're on a chair, you might make sure that your feet are touching the ground. You can roll your shoulders up, back and down, softening your face, your jaw, your forehead, and allowing the body to hang. Melting into the chair and the earth. And consciously softening. Softening any tension. And you can decide to keep your eyes slightly open if that's most comfortable for you. Close your eyes. We notice that we're inhabiting a breathing body. we don't need to do anything. And the breath is happening automatically on its own terms. We might notice that we're breathing deeply this evening, or that the breath is shallow. It could be long, could be short. We're not trying to change the breath. We're feeling into the quality of breathing from the inside. We can allow the breath to breathe itself. Bringing to this meditation a soft, gentle, tender presence. Receiving the breath in that spirit. You might notice that the mind is engaged with thoughts, sensations in the body, and that's okay as well. When we notice that type of activity, we gently bring our attention back to the breathing body. Knowing that you're breathing. You might also notice other physiological processes in the body, like the circulation and the heart beating. And this is also welcome. returning to this tender, and if another type of experience pulls you away and requires your attention, feel free to go there. It's a pain in the body, racing thoughts. And allow some time there. That same presence. And then once a particular experience loses its momentum, coming back to breathing. Returning to what it feels like sitting down on a chair or on the floor. And expanding your awareness to include other sensations, other phenomena like sounds, the temperature in the room. Anything you can smell. The feeling of being with others, if you're in a room with others. And the felt sense of that. And staying in meditation, but allowing the body to move in whatever way it wants to. Intentionally moving your
feet or your fingers. You might want to stay in stillness, which is perfectly fine too. And including the visual sense by opening your eyes and taking in any sights in front of you. You might notice that the eyes want to move. Allowing any objects, light, textures be seen by the eyes. Thank you for your practice.
Well, thanks so much, Dean. Beautiful. When you gave us permission to like move during the meditation, it's like, oh, I can be like really naughty and like wiggle my toes.
Yeah. Oh. Really breaking bad, right?
But it's interesting because like stillness, like from the suttas, like the Buddha never says you have to sit still and never move in meditation. Stillness is something that emerges from tranquility rather than something that you enforce through will. Yeah. Nice. Okay, so everyone, let's have okay, good. So we're all here. Okay, so for this evening, Nadine and I would like to structure this more of a conversation. So we'll have a bit of a chat about the relevant topics. I would like to also engage people here as well. But there's a few points I think that we want to cover, but mostly we just wanted to sort of engage with people and just bring up issues and so on. So the topic is misogyny, Just very briefly as to the background, I was approached by the editors for this book. They're doing the contemporary book, Bloomsbury Contemporary Book of Buddhist Ethics, which they want to do as a kind of, I think they mean it as a, like a approachable book for undergrad students who can learn about how Buddhists would engage with various contemporary ethical issues. And so they wanted me to do a chapter on, they have multiple authors per chapter. So, oops, computer just crashed. Nice. We're back again. Hang on, let me just see what's happening here. Okay, so sorry, everybody. The computer just crashed here. Are we okay online? We're okay? Okay, so hopefully we're good. This just does a local glitch. So they have different contributors for different chapters. So there'll be a few people contributing to each chapter. I did one on AI and one on misogyny. And as I did the chapter on misogyny, my idea was that I'm going to be honest, I kind of feel like this argument in this chapter is like really embarrassing that we even have to say it, but I basically wanted to argue that misogyny is incompatible with Buddhism, which I know should be too obvious to need saying, but apparently is not. So I basically went through the Noble Eightfold Path and especially the first five factors of the Noble Eightfold Path and argued that each of these was incompatible with misogyny. That was the basic idea. But halfway through it, I got kind of bogged down and didn't know how to proceed. So I reached out to Nadine and she made it possible for it all to happen. So that's how we started working on this topic. Nadine, I'm not sure if all of our people here know what misogyny means. What is it about?
It's a good thing if you don't know what it means, probably. I don't know.
Right? Maybe you don't have if you haven't had to learn.
Yeah. So, we have been talking about misogyny, which obviously is a word that you use to describe some kind of experience or phenomena, social
right.
phenomena.
Right.
And I know that you defined it as an inner defilement.
Right.
And you also said that, you know, from your perspective, it's an attitude.
Right.
And the attitude relates to women, and that attitude is usually hateful,
right.
aversive,
yeah.
And that it leads to certain behavioural actions like cruelty. So I think that's roughly how we defined it in the article.
Right.
And I've been reflecting on the definition a bit myself right. since we wrote the article. And it's quite interesting because I've never thought about it so deeply
right.
in a way. And it's very easy to describe hatred of women as misogyny,
right.
particularly because that's a very explicit expression of misogyny.
Right.
But I do think there are more subtle versions of misogyny.
Right.
And it might be interesting to talk more about those as well.
Yeah.
Because it's not simply about, you know, those people who have really strong views about women, like fringe individuals that we see, like on the manosphere, for example.
Not sure how fringe it is, but anyway.
Okay, yeah. That will explicitly say, I don't like women, they're not giving
right.
me what they want, right?
Right.
Misogyny actually runs much deeper than that.
Right.
And in a way, I would argue that we're all kind of involved.
For sure.
Yeah. So it's much bigger than, you know, hatred of women.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, although in Buddhism, like when we use the word hatred in Buddhism, basically it's meant as a very broad term, right? So it's meant as a very broad, it's not just I'm your nemesis and I'm going to kill you, but it's any kind of negative or critical attitude. So yeah, that breadth is definitely there. But I think like most, there's relatively few people who would like overtly say, you know, I hate women and women are bad. And there are obviously a not insignificant number who would say that,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of the manifestation in sexist attitudes, discriminatory attitudes, and all of those kinds of things, I think it's a lot more common. Certainly, it's a lot more common than I've had to learn. Like I've had to learn about it as an adult.
And now, can you see it more readily?
I don't know.
Mm.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think once we have some language around this, we start to see it more clearly.
Right.
And often for women, I think I can speak for myself anyway, we have a sense that something's off. Yeah.
Right.
And we have a sense that, you know, someone is treating us in a different way, or perhaps they're dehumanizing us or devaluing us, or not affording us an opportunity.
Right.
Or, you know, there are all sorts of expressions, but you might feel like you're being undermined in a workplace and you don't quite know why.
Right.
And this was the same in the 70s for sexual harassment. We didn't actually have any language around sexual harassment at that time.
Okay.
And then as soon as people started using that label, we were able to actually identify behaviours and attitudes, and it was quite helpful. So I think these definitions are important, like just in day-to-day life,
right?
Understanding what this means and being able to notice it.
Right, have some language around it. We were talking a bit earlier about patriarchy. About the different ways that people use that, so I tend to use it as a term for I guess probably because I'm a monk, right? So I'm in ostensibly an organization which is a patriarchy. It's a rule, literally ruled by the fathers, or a hierarchy is a rule by the priests.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so I tend to think of patriarchy as organizations, which are set up like that. And when you look at it, it's basically every major institution in our society is originally a patriarchy, whether it's businesses or education or the judicial system or the police or the military or any kind of organization is a patriarchy set up by men for men. And gradually, in some cases, we've made room for women in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ongoing kind of process. Mm-hmm. But that's something that I really have had to learn about, like how male institutions defend themselves against the possibility of women. The possibility of women.
Yeah. Scary.
Right?
You should be very scared.
Yeah. And the whole kind of emotions and energy that come up around that.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
Like when we did one of the areas that I dealt with was doing bhikkhuni ordination, supporting full ordination for women in Buddhism. And when we did that, to me this is really kind of very obvious, we should be supporting women in practice. But anyway, surprised how many of my fellow monks were really not okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy that erupted as a result of that,
mm-hmm.
was incredible. I mean, I felt it like as a physical energy, like there were nights when I didn't sleep.
Yeah.
You know, just that energy, when we were doing the ordination, it just like
got inside you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the kind of explosion of activity from the patriarchy,
uh-huh.
to stop that,
yes.
was unprecedented,
uh-huh.
like completely unprecedented.
I think from a feminist perspective, this idea of backlash and men closing down ranks is very familiar and unsurprising.
Yeah.
But if you haven't had an experience of that, it can be kind of traumatizing.
Right.
And I think that men sometimes are quite shocked when this happens.
Yeah.
Particularly if you haven't been, in that situation before, so that makes sense.
Definitely, yeah. And another thing that was really obvious was that the when we did the bhikkhuni ordination, that the nuns were much more cool about the whole thing than the monks were. The monks were like, "What the hell's going on?" And they were like, "This is what's going on."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was talking to Bhante before about our different positions, because we occupy different positions in the Buddhist space. It's interesting because Bhante, occupies a male position and a senior male position. And so you have different eyes on you, and also you need to, you have a responsibility, an ethical responsibility. And I occupy a bit of a different position as, a feminist and someone who works mainly with women. So our concerns are a little bit different, though we come together on some major points.
So you're contrasting being a male with being a feminist?
No. Some of the best feminists I know are males.
Just to clarify point.
Including you, no. But what I was thinking about as I was thinking through the topic was that, in a way I don't feel responsible for misogyny. And I don't feel like it's a problem that I need to fix. What I do feel responsible for is, well, it's the feminine or the female or the feminist imagination, okay, and how I can contribute to that.
Okay.
And also I'm concerned with this notion of agency. And so, you know, it's quite remarkable that right. women remain in patriarchal institutions.
Right.
And they do so sometimes with a lot of, like, creativity, right? Because yeah. they have to duck and weave, and they also have to retain a strong sense of self and right. self-respect.
Right.
And so women's agency is, it's crucial to support and also talk about explicitly, I think. Right. And so, you know, it's not easy as a woman in patriarchal institutions.
Right.
So if you're a bhikkhuni or a Buddhist, even just a lay practitioner,
right.
and you're hearing that there's all this blowback,
right.
And that men don't believe that women should take up a full spiritual position in a community,
right.
that really hurts.
Yeah.
And to stay in that environment and not just abandon ship, that takes a lot of strength, a lot of courage and grit. So
right.
yeah, hats off to all those women, right?
And it's so conflicted, like there's this inner conflict because they know that something's going on that's not right.
I know. I think I've said to you before, like, why didn't I just become a Wiccan? Like,
uh-huh.
It's like, that's pro-woman.
Uh-huh.
Like, why did I stay in Buddhism,
uh-huh.
knowing that there were all these individuals trying to undermine my position, you know?
But, you know, like, etymologically, Wicca is just vija from Pali,
yeah.
knowledge.
Yeah.
So Wiccanism is just Buddhism anyway.
that explains it. Yeah.
So, yeah. So anyway, so we both, yeah, I guess we both, like, negotiate these things in different ways. But like that thing you said, like me being like this patriarch, like, I find it incredibly annoying when people kind of project this patriarchal stuff on me, and I try to negotiate it successfully, but not, you know, not always doing so. But one of the roles that I can do, one of the roles that I try to bring, is to use my perspective in scholarship
mm-hmm.
to try to make a difference. And I just want to say, like, I don't think there's anything particularly, like it's just one thing that somebody does, right? So I mean, it's just what happens to be what I do. I'm not saying it's the best way or it's the most important way, but it's one way of addressing it.
Yeah.
And so when I do my translation work, then I'm always kind of trying to be aware of presenting the Buddhist texts in a way that, for a start, doesn't impute sexist attitudes or diminishing attitudes that are not there in the text, which does happen in a few cases. I don't think it happens that often, but it does happen in some cases.
Mm.
But I also, like, because I want to have, like, an honesty, I think I also struggle with some texts that are, well, are they misogynistic? Or some texts which are, certainly seem to be misogynistic and often regarded as such.
It would be a problem if you weren't struggling with them.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought we might read one short text.
Mm-hmm.
So this Rains Retreat, for those of you who've been coming along will know that we've been doing readings from the Anguttara Nikaya. So the Anguttara Nikaya is one of the books in the Pali canon, which is here. Okay, so this has all of them. That's the 28 books. This is one of those books. And the Anguttara Nikaya, this is one of the five books of the Anguttara Nikaya, five or six, anyway. And so this is a short little sutta. Now, some people take this as being having a negative or critical attitude towards women. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read this sutta out, and then we're going to get some responses, okay? So I want you to listen to this sutta, and whatever you feel, it's all right, okay? We're not expecting a right answer or anything, but we're going to get some feedback from you all about what this evokes in you. Okay, so this is Anguttara Nikaya 5.230. And I'm sure probably Venerable Prasanna or somebody will pop the link in online for those who want to put that there. Thank you so much, Venerable. Mendicants, there are these five drawbacks of a black snake. What five? It's irritable, acrimonious, venomous, forked-tongued, and treacherous. These are the five dangers of a black snake. in the five ways there are these five, in the same way there are these five dangers of a female. What five? She's irritable, acrimonious, venomous, fork-tongued, and treacherous. This is a woman's venom. Usually, she's very lustful. This is a woman's forked tongue. Usually, she speaks divisively. This is a woman's treachery. Usually, she's an adulteress. These are the five dangers of a woman. Who said this? So the first question, good question, okay? Who said this? So this from the Anguttara Nikaya, okay? I just read out the whole sutta, okay? So everything else we can say about it is speculative. All I'm saying is that's what's in that text there. Like normally when we present a sutta like that, we kind of assume it's probably the Buddha speaking. But there's no actual setting or attribution here. It doesn't actually say who's the speaker. Okay. Why do you ask? Do you think that that sounds like something the Buddha would say?
Well, I mean, no, but I'm curious, who would that
sort of
world said
that? Who in that world said that? Yeah. We will come back to that question, but that's a good question. But how are people responding to that? No.
I think I get particularly peeved at this. What I pick up, like some sort of narrative that women are always, it's always the woman, the female, right, that is swaying others by, what were the words?
The woman is usually very lustful.
Lustful and adulterous?
Adulterous,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay, yeah, look, thank you for that. So it's like stereotyping, right? It's not saying
like
that
anyone can feel lust to any gender and and objectify or, you know,
I can hear
engage
a certain,
in sexual stuff. Yeah.
I can hear a certain dissatisfaction there, but that's true, yeah. Yeah.
I like to point out that the Buddha gave a lot of teachings in his 40-some years, and he gave the same teaching to different groups of people. So he always spoke to the group of people that he was with at the time. And therefore, some of the teachings on the same subject are quite different. So I can imagine that he gave this teaching to a group of monks.
Okay.
And so he used women as the example because in other teachings he said, well, what's foremost on a man's mind is women. And this is a way to teach the monks some way to stop thinking about women and get down to meditating on the things that they should be speaking about.
Okay.
And so it really only pertains to that group of people, and really would be taking it out of context to say that he would be being misogynistic to women in particular, because he'd never say it to a woman and he wouldn't act that way to a woman.
Okay. Thank you for that. Do you have any response to that?
Not yet.
You sure? That's like a really kind of common thing to that. I'm going to answer that as a monk, okay? And I'm going to say for myself as a monk, I've never heard any monks talking like that to monks, okay? Like I've been a monk for 30 years. I've never heard of a monk talking in that way about women to monks, and I've never heard of any monk who's actually been helped by thinking about women in that kind of way. So look, that's that idea that the Buddha is teaching in different contexts to different people, that is very much a valid concern. But I'm not sure. I think there's also a point in which we can sort of bend over backwards to explain something. But I'll just leave it there. We're going to come back to this question later. But I'm just interested to hear from some more people. Yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to understand if there is a teaching beyond women being these things in this context, because I also object to the way the snake is treated.
Thank you. What's wrong with snakes, right? Yeah, that's a kind of literary trope, but fair enough. Yeah, nothing wrong with black snakes. Yeah. So Fabian.
Two questions. Well, one is context. I would like to know more about the context of this sutta. And the other one is, I wonder if Buddha did ever he talk to women?
Did the Buddha ever talk to women?
Yes.
I believe so, yes.
So what did she say about men? What did he say about men?
So is there an equivalent sutta for men? Like very briefly on the context, right? So this is quite normal, right? So the Buddha did in fact do different teachings to different people, and quite often you might find like inverted or mirrored teachings and so on in different contexts. This is true. We don't find such an inverted context like that for this particular text. We don't find an equivalent text for men or something like that. But I'll just leave it for there. But yeah, the context is obviously very important. How did anyone feel when I was reading that text? Did anyone who felt inspired? Who felt joyful? Did anybody feel like, oh, previously I had like doubts about the Buddha, but now those doubts have gone and I feel this is the path for me? Did anybody feel like that?
I wanted to believe that this is not something the Buddha said.
So you this want to believe?
Someone had.
Yeah.
You know, it's cultural.
Okay.
And it was
okay.
Home at the time and someone.
Okay, so we want to believe that it's something that the Buddha didn't speak. Okay, that's fine. Anybody else? Yeah.
But then I also think what's actually changed, because certain people still have those attitudes towards women nowadays.
Right.
Even the thing with like the forked tongue and the acrimoniousness.
Right.
You know, you can sort of extrapolate that to say how people normally think about very opinionated women.
Right.
But strong opinions and
yep.
how a man who has similar opinions, who's as strong in his opinions, doesn't get treated the same way. So
right.
what's changed, really?
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. So that's very much still the case, isn't it? Yeah. So if a man has an opinion, this is normal.
Mm-hmm.
If a woman has an opinion, she's being mouthy. Mm-hmm. And
I think that's from.
Anyway, we can address. Well, you might address the comments towards the end if you get a chance. Okay, so thanks everybody for that. I think generally it's okay. Look, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to very briefly break down some of the ways that I would use to approach a statement like that. So first thing to do is I would ask in terms of the four kinds of right speech. Can anyone tell me what are the four kinds of right speech or four attributes of right speech? It's truthful.
Yeah.
All right, next one.
Not harsh.
No, not divisive, that it be pleasing, right? Not divisive, and that it be useful or meaningful. Okay, so if we understand this particular context, does this meet that requirement, right? So first of all, are these things true? So for example, it says here that women are mostly adulteresses, okay? So I'm not going to ask you to put your hands up, okay? But there have... I'm not. I said I'm not going to. Okay. But there have been quite a lot of studies on this, and you'll be shocked to know that men commit adultery more, significantly more than women. Okay.
And actually, that was a strange moment happened on my Saturday morning after I came out of yoga. I got an email from you saying, can you find out about infidelity amongst women?
Yeah.
And I thought, no one's ever asked me that on a Saturday morning, but sure. And so I went down a huge rabbit hole, and the statistics are actually like there's not a lot out there because it actually is very hard to measure. But
right.
Yes. And I was trying to find global statistics, not just Australian statistics.
Right.
And what I did find is that more men report wanting to cheat on their partner than women, though a decent amount of women report the same thing.
Sure.
And more men have experience with infidelity as compared to women.
Right.
So, yes, I think statistically we're saying the right thing.
Yeah.
We're saying this sound.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just to say it was strange, I was on like a rabbit hunt looking for these stats.
That's the great thing about doing research. You're looking up all these completely bizarre things.
Yeah.
But also, I think the statistics that I've seen it's always been like the number is significantly less than half. Like it's usually between 20-40% or something.
Amongst
like that.
The women,
just generally speaking, yeah, something like that. So then, if we say, well, women are mostly adulteresses, obviously that seems that's not true, right? That's something we can assess. It's not true. And we can analyze these things, the other factors in that way as well. So that's giving us something. The next one was whether it was pleasing. And we just asked about that. And it seems, generally speaking, we agree that it wasn't particularly inspiring. Now, it's okay to use harsh words in certain cases if it needs be. And we do find that the Buddha did that sometimes. If there is usually a context that really demands that, like when the Buddha was, you know, addressing Devadatta after he tried to murder him or something like that. So sometimes you can speak harshly or strongly if there's a need for it. Third, but doesn't seem to apply here. Third one is it harmonious? Right? This is, I think, one of the most important ones, actually, because this is this kind of speech is so divisive. It turns people against each other, and it's really corrosive to relationships and so on. And the way, especially, that it's being pumped out through social media and so on today, it's just shocking.
Yeah.
Just you saw in the Guardian on the way here, actually, that Tanya Plibersek's talking about how, like, if a boy goes onto social media, they'll see misogynistic content within, I think, 23 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just massively being pumped through algorithms and so on because it fuels hate and it fuels clicks. So the divisiveness on it, and also the meaningfulness of it. So in a Dhamma context, meaningful means, is it conducive to the path? Does it actually help you to realize nirvana? And again, I can't really see that it passes those things. So this is the kind of the method that I used in, or that we used in the article, was to look at, you know, look at these things in terms of those fundamental teachings. Does this actually fit the criteria that the Buddha himself gave for giving something which is right speech? And we can say, well, no, it doesn't fit that criteria of right speech. So what actually is going on? Okay, so here is where we have some fun. Who knows what Tocharian is?
Yeah.
Anyone know Anders?
It's an Indo-Aryan language.
Oh, my
from
God.
From Turkey.
Oh, my God.
From current-day Turkey.
I think it's Turkic, but I don't know if it's from Turkey.
I thought it was Turkic. I read about it in the book called Proto.
Proto, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
that's good enough. That's pretty good. Okay. So Tocharian was one of the languages. It's recovered from manuscripts found in Gilgit, which is more or less on the border between China, India, and Pakistan. And they found these caves with thousands and thousands of manuscripts in it, and some of it was in languages which were unknown. And one of them has been deciphered, and we now have some texts in that language called Tocharian. So our friend in Sydney Uni, Mark Allen, is one of the people who works in this field, or he works in Gandhari, but still a similar kind of field. Anyway, so these are mostly Buddhist manuscripts. And so some of these have been recovered and published from Tocharian. So Venerable Analia, when he was doing his study on this, so he's done text critical studies of these particular suttas. One of the things that he pointed out was that normally we find that most early Buddhist suttas have parallels in Chinese translations, so probably like 80% of them. Others also have versions in Sanskrit and Tibetan, but this sutta doesn't have any parallels anywhere. And the other suttas, there it's like maybe four or five other suttas in Anguttara Nikaya that have a similar kind of slant, and none of these all have any parallels either. So the only parallel we find for this Black Snake Sutta is in a Tocharian manuscript. And the Tocharian manuscript gives us the context, which we were asking about from the beginning, like, what is the context for this? So we now have a context. The context is this. There are a bunch of Sakyan youths. So Sakya was the clan of the Buddha. But you should know that just being a Sakyan doesn't mean that you're a good guy in the Buddhist narratives. Okay? Don't assume that because someone's from like one of the Buddha's mates that therefore he was a good guy. Actually, Sakyans were like often terrible people, and like most of the bad people in the Sangha were Sakyans. Devadatta, Upananda, there's a whole bunch of them. Anyway, not necessarily terrible people, but they certainly had their problems. Anyway, moving on. So a bunch of Sakyan youths, right, teenage boys, telling a bunch of women that the Buddha said that women were like five dangers of women like black snakes. So they were quoting this sutta to these women, and the women were like, what's this about? They went to see the Buddha, and the Buddha taught them about the five virtues of women instead.
So why is that not in there?
So let's just, we'll come to that in a second. So just rest on that for a minute, okay? So think about how that reframes that whole narrative. The Pali text has no context. And we impute to that the context as was spoken by the Buddha, but a Tocharian text, and we can't really say what is the relationship of that Tocharian text to the original context. Is this something that draws on the original context, or is it something that was invented later to contest the original reading? These all possibilities. You can certainly say that there was a tension within the Buddhist tradition about the interpretation of this sutta. So it certainly represents that. And it tells us that a bit of context can radically change the entire meaning and sense of a text. Now, my personally, as a text scholar, I would say that it's quite common that later texts might recontextualize like a teaching from the early suttas. This is quite common. But I very much doubt whether somebody would be deliberately giving the opposite meaning of what's in the suttas. That's really unusual. That would be really unusual. So personally, I think most likely that there was some context which was maybe lost in the Pali version, maybe not exactly the same, but something like that. But yeah, at the very least, it reminds us that those questions that we were asking from the beginning are genuine questions. Is this actually from the Buddha? We don't know. Okay, and if you're struggling with it, I personally give you permission as a text critical scholar to say, don't worry about it. Yeah. Which then remains the question that Anders just asked about why it's there in the first place, which is another whole kind of thing. Yeah. So are we good?
They're Buddhist texts,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they're Buddhist texts from different schools of Buddhists. This is basically in the Silk Road. So they're Buddhists going from China to India, and then they made this compendium. It has all different kinds of Buddhist texts in there, like Mahayana texts, early Buddhist texts, all kinds of things.
So yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm just going to say, like, is this also what happens in Christianity with the Bible? Like, when people, you know, it says love thy neighbor, but people take things from the Bible and they misconstrue it. And is it similar in Buddhism as well?
Absolutely can be, yeah. I think, I mean, look, I don't want to get too much into sort of comparative stuff, but I feel like in the Bible there are a lot of really terrible things. Right? I'm not going to kind of list them, but there's a lot of them and they're really terrible. Whereas in Buddhist texts, there's a lot less, this is as bad as it gets. Okay? So in case you're wondering about it, this is like the worst text in the Pali canon, I think, pretty much down there. So it's all kind of uphill from there. Yeah. So we don't, like, and I think in Buddhism we don't, I feel like we haven't, like, exercised our ability to engage critically with these kinds of things. So this is one of the reasons why I want to just talk about a bit about the textual context, is to show that, like, it's actually, there are actually meaningful ways to consider it from a Buddhist framework. Yeah. It's not just arbitrary, it's not just I don't like this, right? But we can actually look at it from a Buddhist perspective and say, well, does this meet the criteria that we expect? Dylan, sorry.
I don't know if you mentioned that, I missed it, but does a Tocharian text like explicitly mention whether or not Buddha said that he gave that discourse to the Sakya youths?
I'm not entirely sure. I didn't read the Tocharian text myself. I only read the paraphrase of it from Venerable Anadio. But usually he's pretty literal in what he presents in his work, right? So he'll just say literally what the text says. It seems that the Buddha just responded with the counter narrative. I'm not sure whether the Buddha said that he did not say that in a previous text or not. Yeah, it also may be fragmentary. I'm not exactly sure. A lot of these manuscripts are very old, so yeah.
But did you find anywhere in the sutta which talks about the dangers of men?
Is there anywhere in the sutta that talks about the dangers of men? No. Obviously. Well, why would that be?
Why didn't he include it?
Well, are there no dangers to men?
They're very dangerous.
Are they?
Well, think about it. We're talking about the domestic violence statistics.
Right.
One woman per week in Australia is killed at the hands of a man.
Right.
This is a danger we need to be aware of.
Right. So, yeah, not just aware of, but right, try to change or try to do what we can. But one of the things that we find, like, from patriarchal, like, texts that stem from a patriarchy is not just overt texts like this, but also the omission of discussing things like domestic violence and stuff.
Though there are certain protections in Buddhism.
For sure, yeah.
For female monastics, at least.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so the Buddha did think through risks like rape.
That's true, and it's kind of interesting. Like, if you look at the Indian culture more generally, like, so the Buddha didn't like legislate for lay people very much, right? Mm-hmm. Gave some ethical principles, and there's actually quite a few things, not all that much. But clearly, the kind of like marital arrangement that the Buddha preferred was of a marriage by love based on mutual respect.
Uh-huh.
Rather than, say, arranged marriage or something like that. You have like ideal marriages presented, and when ideal marriages are presented, they're presented in a very equal way, that both partners trust each other and respect each other and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting that in the Indian culture, obviously people get used to saying, oh, that was a patriarchal culture and women were discriminated against, which is obviously true. But at the same time, there's quite a number of things that aren't as bad as things are today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or at least are debatable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, the Terigata and all of those accounts of, you know, women's bold quest and awakening and achievement in the spiritual domain. I mean, we see less of that these days.
Right.
But maybe it's partially because people don't reveal these details. But, you know, in terms of a really, really strong canonical basis for women's spiritual development and a path going forward, it's quite remarkable, really.
Right.
And, yeah, when you really start to read those stories, you also realise that the private and spiritual, so what I mean is like the domestic sphere and the spiritual sphere are not necessarily distinguished in the way we might understand it in modern times.
Right.
So a lot of those women are talking about, you know, their domestic lives.
Right.
And how they related to their domestic life, and then how they found freedom from, you know, the perils of living a very hard life, very harsh life.
So these days we have trad wives, and when I was in Germany, was it one of the Bikuni monasteries and something, and then we started talking about trad nuns as well.
I'm reading a book called Yesteryear at the moment, which. Uh-huh. Is critically acclaimed, and it's about trad wife life.
Okay.
It's brilliant. It's a fictional account.
Okay.
But it also captures like the real darkness, you know, like it's hard to articulate the darkness, but this author does a beautiful job of it.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, you know, why is this so wrong? You know, like what's going on here?
Yeah, yeah.
And it would be easy just to say, oh, you know, people are reverting back to the 1950s, but actually something else is happening because like the camera's on as well, and like Instagrams, live Instagrams are happening.
And
there's something.
It isn't the 50s.
That's right.
Notably. Yeah.
And like it's a huge business, right? So capitalism is intersecting with these traditional values. So something new is happening.
Do you guys know what trad wife means?
No.
Do we have trad wife? Some do, some don't. What's a trad wife?
It's a movement. It's a movement of women in particular who are wanting to obviously like reclaim some traditional values and gender roles. And often they are wanting to move into the country and tend to animals.
make their own food from scratch, and raise many children with their partner. And they, the strange thing about trad wives is that they're very, very interested in image.
Right.
And so it's not just about experiencing the country and multiple children, it's actually about portraying a certain image. And so there's a kind of like an ideological motivation.
Yeah.
And so I was just, what I was saying to Bunte was that there are a lot of people who, like, they have a camera crew,
right,
like in the homestead,
right?
Right. And like, you know, little Johnny and Penny, and they all come out for breakfast, and like it's all, like it's a scene, you know,
right.
And then it's live streamed and they become influencers. And so it's a complex movement. I wouldn't say it's simple, and I wouldn't say that women have no agency in it either, but it's intriguing.
Well, women are allowed to be evil.
That's right. What a great freedom.
Sorry?
Is it a religious movement?
Somewhat, yeah, it's somewhat religious. So
I mean, it's associated with conservative Christianity.
Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, I mean, it's also creepily eugenicist.
Yes.
Like they're all perfect blonde Aryans.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right. My personal theory about the trad wife movement is that when I was in Germany in a few years ago, there was an election,
mm-hmm.
and the outcome of the election, like a lot of people were talking about how young men were being influenced towards the extreme right.
Uh-huh.
But the demographics that came back from that particular election were that the young men basically voted more or less similarly to the population as a whole. But the actual outline, which is probably means that they've shifted to the right, because normally younger people would vote to the left.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
So but they voted on the whole similarly to the whole demographic, but the real demographic outlier was young women who voted overwhelmingly for the progressive and leftist parties in that particular election. And I think that the forces of darkness are using the trad wife mechanism specifically in order to drive young women towards the extreme right.
Oh, you could be right there.
Yeah. I think that's not like a conspiratorial argument, but the money flows towards, you know.
Absolutely.
In that kind of way.
And that's what this book does beautifully, is it links these seemingly domestic activities,
right,
to like political movements.
Right.
And I think that's something that I wanted to mention in our conversation for some reason. I can't remember why exactly, but I was thinking politics attaches to everything,
right,
including text. And so and so feminists, you know, a long time ago were saying that the personal is political.
Right.
So what happens, you know, in the private sphere is political,
right.
And so we kind of lost sight of that for some reason. Buddhism is political, and political is not a dirty word,
right.
Is it? I don't know, maybe, but no, I don't think it is.
Is political dirty word? Okay, so I went to stay at this monastery a while ago, and I said, well, and they had this sign up there saying no talks about politics.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm like, fine, whatever. And the senior monastic in that time that I was there was constantly talking about politics, but it was all petty monastic politics.
Right, yeah.
So that is okay, but politics that actually matters apparently is not. Yeah. I don't think that they knew that that was actually politics. They didn't consider that politics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think if we don't talk about politics,
right,
we don't talk about misogyny,
right,
then we're kind of acquiescing, right, in a way.
Okay.
And I would like to see Buddhists talk more explicitly about politics, but we need to actually empower people, because
right,
they don't actually know how to talk about difficult things,
right,
I found.
Right.
And they don't know how to talk to power either.
Right.
And so I see a lot of submission,
okay,
and deference.
Okay.
And I think women in particular sometimes adopt that role. And that concerns me.
Right.
That itself concerns me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. There's another sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha has a series of questions about what does so and so want, like what does a thief want, what does a warrior want, what does a king want, and so on. And one of them is, what does a woman want? Right? A rather fraught question to be asking in a text by a man. The answer is Isarya, which literally means sovereignty. Isarya is the same quality which is wielded by a king, and it's the same quality, in fact, which is that which is wielded by literally the creator God.
Mm-hmm.
is the sovereign lord, is the Israel. And so that to me is like an acknowledgement of what you were saying about that need for that self-determination and being able to make up, you know, have your own choice in things like marriage and household and all of those things. Yeah.
And spiritual life.
Yeah.
And men don't want to give up their sovereignty.
Right.
So it's like it's got a lot to do with their power.
Right.
Are they saying that they want sovereignty because they don't have it in that context?
I mean, it's obviously an issue.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise it wouldn't be mentioned. Yeah. It's interesting. It's the same quality which you said of like what does a Kshatriya want? So Kshatriya is from the royal caste or the knightly caste, the warrior caste. That's what they want, is Isarya as well. They want the sovereignty.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes. What do women want? What a silly question. It's repeated over and over in
right.
all sorts of book titles these
right.
days, right?
Right?
Cosmopolitan magazine.
Right.
What don't we want, really, is the question.
Well, I guess if you have sovereignty, then you can get anything else.
Freedom is, yeah,
maybe,
yeah. For sure.
Yeah. So do we have, okay, I'm going to, Nadine, did you have anything you wanted to specially discuss before we finish?
There was one last thing
Please.
That I thought we should talk about.
Okay.
And really it's about how misogyny is sustained
okay.
or reproduced. Yeah. And
okay.
so, and I mentioned earlier this idea that we're all kind of implicated,
right.
including myself.
Right.
Because I actually think that misogyny expresses itself through cultural story and cultural
okay.
myth. Okay. And that kind of impacts us,
right.
shapes us. And so one of the things that I've noticed in Buddhist communities, not
yeah.
so much in feminist communities, but Buddhist communities, is that people feel they need to keep male secrets.
Okay.
And so when they notice male yeah. secrets, so when they notice bad behavior,
yeah.
They don't have the tools or the language or the willingness to necessarily speak out about it,
yeah.
which is understandable, because I don't actually think we have a strong community of allies in the Buddhist community that can support people to speak out.
Right.
But also I think it's very natural to feel compassion, right,
yeah.
towards people who are suffering. And
yeah.
often these men that we're talking about are suffering,
right.
And they're experiencing, you know, a narrow sense of self and
right.
perception and
exactly,
narrowing.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're also
like a narrowing and a hardening.
Yeah.
You know? You become something that you didn't want to be.
It's awful.
Yeah.
And so, like, I have that. I feel a lot of, like, empathy.
Yeah.
And so it makes it difficult to be able to say, like, no, you know what, that behavior's not on. And
yeah.
and what I also find myself is that I feel guilt and shame because
mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm not being a good Buddhist if I'm,
yeah.
you know, calling out bad behavior.
Right.
But part of the reason I'm saying all of this is because we talk about suffering a lot,
right.
but we don't talk about harm and violence and cruelty. And
right.
there's like a dynamic in cruelty,
right?
There's
right.
someone who's inflicting cruelty on the other.
Right.
And that is happening. That
right.
happens all the time.
Yeah.
And so we need to be able to talk about this. I'm
yeah.
not saying we should shame people or shun them.
Yeah.
Like, I'm against that. I like to actually work with perpetrators where I can.
Okay.
But we need to include people with those kind of, I'd call them, like, you know, maladaptive, cruel behaviours,
okay.
And be able to speak about their behaviour publicly
mm.
and amongst ourselves and support each other in that. You know, that's
yeah.
it's really like a call.
Right.
And so you told me that I wasn't allowed to make people feel better. You said this is a dark week. And I'm sorry if I'm
Nadine wanted to offer some hope to people. I'm like, this is really not what this session is about. But anyway, go on.
No,
go
that's
on.
It,
be,
that's
a,
it.
Be a rebel.
No,
go
I
on,
just
Nadine.
I no, I'm just it's a wish list. I want more allies and I want us to move into this courageous space.
Yeah.
And I don't really like, and the hierarchy also gets in the way of that.
Sure, yeah.
So what, like, have you got a response to those?
Well, you're doing some work in that regard with the other Buddhas, like Venerable Metta and with Sakatita and so on. Do you want
yeah.
to tell people what you're doing with that?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing, I'm involved in the Safe Buddhism Initiative, which is being pioneered by someone called Venerable Metta, which will be a website.
Okay.
And that website will contain information about spiritual and sexual abuse in Buddhist communities. And potentially the next stage of it might include a group of trained people who can handle disclosures
right.
and support individuals in those situations.
Okay.
So that's one such initiative, and it's going to be launched very soon.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm also involved in Sakyadita, which attempts to elevate the voices of women in public spheres. And one of the things I say is that, you know, I can talk, it's nice to talk, you know, but I need other people to talk to, you know, like I don't want to be monopolizing the space. So it's really important that we get other women's voices elevated and platformed.
Right.
Yeah. And platforming is such a huge part of this. And I appreciate you platforming me today. I mean, that doesn't go unnoticed, right? and so platforming's a big part of it.
Yeah, thanks for that. And thank you for the work that you're doing with Safe Buddhism Initiative. And if anybody's interested in that, please do contact Nadine. Because that's an ongoing thing. Can I ask you a question? Because we're talking about voices, we're talking about normalizing or enabling, like the revealing of male secrets and so on.
Yes.
The Buddha, I mentioned before that in certain cases the Buddha used very strong language. One of the rare cases where he used very strong language was when he responded to a group of monks who were keeping silence in a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Why are you foolish men living together like pigs? Why are you foolish men living together like sheep? Why are you foolish men leaping together like cattle?" And I do take your point. Nothing wrong with pigs, sheep, and cattle, okay? But it's just making a point, okay? This is not to be done. I forbid it. This is a practice of other sects. You are not to keep a vow of silence. So that's in the Vinaya, right? In one of those books over there. And in response to that, the Buddha introduced the idea of the invitation. So that for the Sangha community, that we should invite each other to reveal our faults or to admonish each other and to communicate openly about what's going wrong and so on. So this is like a very direct, a very powerful thing. Like these monks who were doing this, they were just off doing a retreat and they said, "Oh, let's practice, do some meditation, maybe we'll keep a vow of silence." And they go and see the Buddha and the Buddha's like landing on them like this. I'd be sitting, if I was one of those monks, I'd be like, "Oh, we just try to keep a retreat." I mean, it must be pretty harsh. But the Buddha obviously made a very strong point at that point. And yet at retreats these days, everyone keeps vows of silence. Yeah. And I've been gradually kind of working my way towards not having vows of silence on retreats over the last several years. I tell this story usually every retreat. In the last retreat I did, we didn't have a vow of silence. And instead just try to encourage people to have right speech, you know, don't be talking around the meditation area and so on. Like one thing about that is like those guys would have taken a vow of silence very seriously. Like they literally wouldn't have spoken a word during those whole 3 months.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not like, you know, I'll be quiet around the meditation area or something. Like. So I'm just wondering how that, but I really feel like that's closely related to this whole messaging around enabling women to have a voice.
Yes.
Because you're basically conditioning people very deeply. Because when you're on retreat, you're meditating and you get conditioned very deeply to the sense of, oh, this is how spiritual development happens.
Yeah.
It happens by not speaking.
That's a really good point.
Right? Yeah. And you come out of that with that conditioning of not speaking is the way forward and speaking is something kind of bad. And I think that's really, I think we really need to question that. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, that's, one silly story comes to mind, and that's that I was on a silent month long and a male teacher annoyed me.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote lots of notes to the manager.
Uh-huh.
And I never got responses, but they thought, why does that feminist keep writing us notes? So you actually can't silence some women. But good point. I also think, you know, and Mo, you mentioned it in the break, there's this whole issue on foot around like cultural norms. And I was thinking about cross-talking. We're talking about cross-talking and how, like, you know, speech across different cultures is different. So in some cultures, it's actually polite to talk over the top of other people. But you know, in white Buddhist circles, it's like, no, you must, you know, listen deeply and then wait your turn. And so there's been a bit of cross-cultural work done around right speech in like
Sorry, which where what cultures is it appropriate to talk over people?
Well, mine.
Being
like kind of Middle Eastern culture, right? And so everyone was just kind of shouting at each other at the table. And it was an expression of love, right? It did look like it from the outside, but we knew it was. But also, like Black culture in America is similar. And so there are different cultural norms around speech and also what we talk about, right? Like the kind of like topics we talk about.
Right.
And so it's not always welcome to just start like talking about dark topics on a Buddhist retreat or like write notes to the manager about like, you know, your feminist sensibility being violated.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of like outside the scope of the discourse or the
right.
parameters of,
yeah.
of speech.
Yeah.
And so like that coffee's really kicking in now, Bunte. So what I was thinking, well, I've been thinking about it lately, and I wrote something for Buddhist Door in the last month. I've been thinking about like what it's not only who speaks, but it's about like what we get to speak about.
Right.
And like there are implicit norms around
right.
that. And so speaking about cruelty like makes you like a Debbie Downer.
Right.
I try and talk about cruelty in a funny way, right, just to lighten things up. But you can't always do that. Sometimes it's just too dark. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
we need to think that through.
Sorry, I seem to have lost the visual. Sound seems to be okay. Back on again. Lynn.
Thank you so much, Monte. Thank you, Nadine. Thank you. Good to see you. Questions. I got a couple people was actually saying that they actually don't want the vinyasa because the vinyasa is actually for the monks and the nuns. They were told that living in the house, it's actually not the things to do. It's giving them bad luck or something. So they wanted to actually just having that set. They don't want the vinyasa set. Please. Thank you, Monte.
Okay, so just a question from Ling, that there's some feedback about the Tipitaka volumes are getting. Some people just want the vinaya, just want the suttas. They don't want the vinaya because they're not monastics and they don't need to know all those rules. Fair enough, right? Fair enough. And there's a lot of technical details, but there's also there's a lot of things in the vinaya that are very useful generally. So things like, for example, the story of Devadatta is found in the vinaya. The story of how the Buddha first set up the community after his enlightenment, that's found in the vinaya. The story of the establishment of the Bhikkhuni order, found in the vinaya. The story of the first and second councils, also found in the vinaya. And so there's a lot of things that are actually very interesting, which you do find. It's not just a list of rules for monks and nuns.
So it's okay for the lay people to read it?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Did everybody hear that? Is that clear? Thank you.
It's okay for lay people to read the video. Okay, very good. So I think, should we take a few of the questions online?
Yeah.
And let's see. We'll see how many we can get. Do you want to respond to that line?
No, I think that's yours, actually.
Says Frank, it's along a research of the Uyghur part of Sutta, creation. All right. All right, so there's an alternate account of the creation of the nuns' organ or nuns' order in Uyghur, welcoming the nuns. Right. Okay. So yes, there's a debate about the interpretation of that particular text. This is another one of those texts recovered from Central Asian region. No, I don't have any particular. I'm generally aware that that text exists, but I'm not aware of that debate. I will, however, be reviewing it during my work on the Anguttara Nikaya in the next year or so. So, come back to me in a year or two. Sounds a bit low. Oops, a bit late for that. Sorry about that. Bloom 3 book related to Buddhist ethics.
So.
No, that's another one you're talking about there. It's environmental ethics. I'm not sure if our one has been announced publicly yet, if they're still putting it together. Somebody was wondering how I was feeling when I was translating that. Got to do your job, mate. Got to do your job.
Taliban.
Okay. Sounds a lot like the way the Taliban frame women as a dangerous vice. Okay, so I'm really tempted to quote Bhikkhu Bodhi right now. Shall I? But I don't know, this was a private communication. I'm not sure if I should say it. Should I?
Just say it.
Just say it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Sumana's around. She's with Bhikkhu Bodhi at the moment. ask for forgiveness if I say anything. But anyway, so when we were doing this Bhikkhuni ordination, Bhikkhu Bodhi said that the monks who are opposing Bhikkhuni ordination wouldn't be alone. They'd have plenty of warm companionship among the Taliban and other people like that.
He's funny as well.
Bhikkhu Bodhi is very funny, and he's quite. He has an elegance and a classicism in his formal writing that is balanced by a snarky, sarcastic side when he's writing privately. Anyway, that's interesting. Yeah, Colin mentions about the idea that Adam and Eve and the snake in the Bible. Yeah, interesting. Supremacy is conditioned to choice of thinking. Yeah, thanks for that, Leanne. So we're just going through the different comments. Not all of them require response. Marianne says, lust is equally present in men and women. Caring emotions is not equally common in both genders, according to her experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this is a cultural thing, whether it's this is, I think there's an acculturation towards a distinction in that way. What do you think?
You should take Gender Studies 101 and work it out. It's the nature, nurture.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't like to prosecute a case either way.
Right.
And it's partly because biology does make a difference. We know that.
Right.
But biology is not the type of biology that people assume. Like, it's not popular biology. It's not deterministic.
Right.
It's actually very alive.
Right.
And environmental. And
right.
So, like, if you had a baby,
right,
your caring instinct may well just get activated if I gave you one
right now.
And something would happen to your brain and your neurology
right
because of your circumstances
right.
And so, like, I wouldn't say that that's entirely social, but I also wouldn't say, I'd say the biology that we've been taught around gender is too simple
and
ideological.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a long response, but that's
no, that's really important.
Yeah.
Biology is so complex and so undisentangleable.
Yes, dynamic, responsive, all those things.
Leanne said, I never married due to this condition of obey and shut up, rules made by men.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay,
Tamara says, as a queer person, I often feel challenged by the notion of training of attitudes towards a pandika in Buddhist texts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Tamara, this is probably going to go down another rabbit hole. I'm sure the fact that you've mentioned that means that you've got some familiarity, but there's been some work on this concept of the pandika done by my friend Venerable Vimala and also Venerable Ramali and so on. Anyway, look, I won't go into a detail because I'd have to review the text. Anyway, Venerable Prasanna has responded. Great, yeah, so they've given the reference there. great, thank you for that. I'm just going to say the other thing about the pandika, which I suspect, but I can't really prove, is the pandika is also supernatural.
Yes, that's interesting.
Scott's
got an interesting point. I think that, you know, there are some really sophisticated theories of violence and cruelty, actually.
Okay.
And I just want to say that, you know, cruelty occurs between the genders,
right?
And sometimes it occurs, you know, from a woman to a man, or
a woman
to a woman, or a man to a man, or
trans
individual or non-binary individual. All sorts of genders are represented there.
Yeah.
All humans can be bad, but I do think that that there are some good theories. And I remember right at the peak of the monstrosities that occurred in Gaza, I read a really excellent piece by someone called, I think it was Jackie French.
Okay.
It was Jackie Rose. in the London Review of Books.
Jackie Rose in the London Review
about,
of Books.
About violence.
Okay.
And so she was theorising violence from a social and a psychoanalytic perspective. And
okay.
she was saying we don't have enough theories of violence.
Okay.
And so, you know, yes, you can say that's violent.
Right.
Like what causes it, and
right.
like it is just like biology, it's complicated and
right.
responsive and situational.
Right. Right.
And so we shouldn't just assume that we know what's going on. And
right.
so actually it's quite important to read into this area a bit if you
right.
can and
right.
you're willing to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in a way it's like very cutting edge to
right.
to think about this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's right at the cusp of good social theory.
Okay.
Because how we and often how we make sense of violence, you know, good guys and bad
right.
guys, is it doesn't capture what actually happens, you know.
Because often it's, I mean, one of the dimensions of it is the long dimension of time. Like it's generational, and it's the abuser becomes the abused becomes the abuser.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, and the role switch in relationships.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so obviously, like if you are subjected to violence, you will retaliate. I mean, that's the human.
Right.
response usually.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Just these some details about the initiatives, about the Safe Buddhist Initiative.
Thank you.
I think Venerable Prasanna doing fantastic work as always. The
mm-hmm.
links for the Sakyadita and the links for the Safe Buddhism Project. That's so fantastic.
Shuni, misogyny. In Australian schools.
Recent report, misogyny in Australian schools. 78% of teachers in Australian schools report observing or experiencing gendered violence in their schools. 1 in 2 report an increase in gendered violence among students. These patterns are consistent for both primary and secondary school teachers. Yeah. And again, like I just want to say from my point of view that this is 100% deliberate. I believe this is nothing about this is, I believe this is real. And it's deliberate. It's deliberately being fostered by, let's just call them Nazis, who want to rip society apart by fostering hate. And the best way to do that, especially, is to create hate and division among young men, because that's your stormtroopers. And that's who the forces of violence will be used to tear society apart.
Sometimes it's the examples these kids are seeing at home.
Sometimes it's examples kids are seeing at home. This is true, but that's also like that's a kind of normal background misogyny.
Yeah.
But the changes in it, I think, is deliberately being driven. Yeah. One of the final points, just to wrap up, we will have to wrap up in a minute, but one of the final points I wanted to make and one of the things I wanted to bring out of the chapter we wrote together was this aphorism that the purpose of a system is what it does.
Yeah.
And when you have organizations whose outcome is cruelty to women, you can't then wash your hands and say, oopsie daisy. It just happens to be the case that we set up an institution that doesn't give women a voice, that refuses to allow women power, that refuses to allow women equality. And oopsie daisy, it just happens to be the case that women get harmed because of that. It's not how it works. And we often tend to absolve, and I think there's a strong sense that we want to absolve the men from their agency. And something that I encountered in Bikuni ordination, all of the monks in senior positions wanted to wash their hands. It was like a Spider-Man meme, everybody pointing at each other. And specifically, you know, you can see specifically the relationship between Thai Buddhism and English Buddhism in that case. The English Buddhists who opposed Bikuni ordination said, we can't do it because the Thais wouldn't let us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Thai Buddhists would say, but like even they're not doing it in the West, so there must be something wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have nothing stopping them, but even they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody's pointing to each other and nobody's taking responsibility. And so to me, that those people, especially those people in leadership positions, some people with some seniority, need to be taking some responsibility. And the purpose, it doesn't just happen to be the case that you're in an organization that doesn't let women have any equality. You've chosen to be in that organization and you've chosen to maintain the organization in this way. And so you can't be just morally absolved from that. You have to be responsible for your choices. That's what you wanted. And this is the outcome that you wanted. Yeah.
Amen.
Erika.
But it's not an issue anymore, right? This bikini ordination.
Oh, it absolutely 100% still is an issue, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Bikini ordination, we went ahead to do bikini ordination in Australia, and we ordained bikinis.
Yeah.
We now have a number of bikini monasteries and communities around Australia. But those who were opposing us, which was led by Ajahn Sumedho and the community in Amrawati in England, they are still opposed to bikini ordination and they still don't accept it. So the leadership came specifically from Ajahn Sumedho himself, and he set up the order which has, you know, opposed and undermined what we're doing. And there were a lot of things that happened in that time I can go in detail of all of the things that happened, but you know, it was clearly a very deliberate attempt to prevent women from ever having equality.
Still not allowed to teach.
Unless they're given specific permission by a man. But if they're given specific permission by a man to teach, then that can't be taken as precedent for allowing them to teach in a future time. Like, these are the rules that they made up at the time that we were doing bikini ordination. They were making up these rules like this. Guys, we're going to have to wrap up. Apologies for everything, but the folks in the centre need to get to sleep.
Yep, fair enough.
And so we will be wrapping up here. Everybody, thank you so much to Nadine for coming over. And I think personally, I really value having Nadine as a friend, and to get to work with you has been really enriching and really beautiful. And I think for the community here, I think it's just so valuable to have yourself as part of this community. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Nadine will be back.
Yes.
On the 7th of November.
Something else to say.
Nice. And so thanks for sticking with us through another dark week. I hope it hasn't been too dark or not dark enough. But anyway, next week we will be back to normal, whatever normal might be. I'm at Parramatta on the 5th. The Parramatta Library, Parramatta Square, 5 Parramatta Square at 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. Please come along if you're in Parramatta. Nadine, do you have anything to promote?
No.
You're doing this course.
Oh, yes.
In our team. People should go and enroll.
Yes,
they
absolutely.
What's the course on?
It's on Applied Mindfulness.
Applied Mindfulness? Yeah, how do you apply mindfulness?
We try really hard.
You try really hard. I'm supposed to not try. Part of the whole
thing? Then we just let go.
Really hard and then let go. But seriously, the Nantian Institute is still they're doing great things down there. So if you're interested in
Buddhist higher education.
The Buddhist higher education.
We would love to see you there. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, thanks everybody. Oh yeah, Tom is going to just say a few words about the Sutta Print project. Nadine, do you want to just, we can just let come out and we will just yield the floor to Tom, and you can come and just, you want to just sit here, because then you can talk to folks online.
Watch the
call. Yeah. Thank you. That's mindfulness.
So we see these books. This is the first edition of the Sutta Pitaka and the Vinaya Pitaka, which was printed in Sri Lanka in 2024 and distributed to the 850 Puravina in Sri Lanka, the Buddhist monastic education centres. And so Australia, New Zealand and the rest of the world raised the funds to get these printed. And so now we're doing a second edition, which is once again being printed in Sri Lanka for distribution in Australia and New Zealand. And so they will be the hand-woven cloth covers, hardback, and as Bandai Sujata is very fond of pointing out, these books invite you to read them because when you open them, they stay open instead of just shutting in your face. And so if you're going to have a set for home, you can pay to fund the printing of that set. The printing is happening in January, February 2027, coming up, and then the distribution when the books arrive in Australia will happen in about April. And so when you're funding, you may want to fund a set for home, as I said. And so why would you want to have a set for home? So you can read them and study them and learn to practice. So Ling and I, inspired by going on retreat with Bande Sujato, came back and read the Sutta and the Vinaya over a period of 18 months. Was just incredible. And you feel so good if you're actually able to get through the whole lot at least once in your life. It just feels fantastic. And there's so much to learn and pick up from that, especially the Vinaya. I mean, people think it's like, oh, it's the law. It's like it's going to be right reading the Australian tax law. No, it's not. It's dramatic. There's drama. There's full of drama. Because it's all, you know, the monastics doing things that had to be pulled up, and like we have to have a rule about this. So there's like this fascinating stories about what's going on, and also the other things that Bande pointed out as well about the Vinaya. So it's well worth going through that. So many things to be picked up in reading. You know, the people coming to the Buddha, the patterns, and the scope of how he taught us. And think about when I was suddenly felt the calling to do this project, to get the printing done, the very next thing I felt was fear to take this on. But then after that, you think about, well, it's 2,600 years of passing on the Dharma and 2,000 years of passing it on in textual form. All the stories about like what people had to go through to get that done, it's incredible, heroic. So here we are in modern times. Oh, it's hard? Not really. Not really, it's just the fear. So you can fund a set to go to a temple, to any temple, and we'll work out which of the 700 temples in Australia or 120 in New Zealand that might go to. Also, we are having some sets stay in Sri Lanka to be distributed there as well. Or it's you can just make a donation, $20. That's one of our strong intentions, is that we want many people to make a contribution so that the benefit of actually contributing to the passing on of the Dharma is spread amongst many people. So we don't have like free distribution in that sense, because we want many people to participate. And so pop over to Sutta Print, ANZ. And then you may make a donation, pay for a set for yourself, or pay for a set for a temple. There's already people here who've donated or purchased sets, so look forward to seeing you participating as well.
And the concert goes to the funds raised from the concert go towards this as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so about the different kinds of fundraising efforts. I'm redeeming 10-cent bottles to raise the money. Sin Sin and Pay are putting on a concert, which is just awesome. So there's lots of ways of contributing for that.
Thanks, Tom. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Tom.
And so if we can do a little photo with some people holding some books before we go, that would be good.
Maybe do it. Can we do it at the front, maybe?
Sure.
Is that okay? Because we do have to shut up because of the folks in the centre. Okay, thanks, everybody. Thank you so much for your patience, and I will see you again next week. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Yeah.